KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Yeah, everything's okay. What we are, I said, this is a transition period. I think we're going to do fantastically.
President Trump downplays growing worries about the economy and the possibility of a recession. For Sunday, May 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Coming up, the world awaits this week's papal conclave in Vatican City, where the cardinals will gather beneath one of the art world's greatest treasures, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel.
They will either face the scenes from the life of Christ or the life of Moses. They will be looking at examples of model priesthood.
Also, the firsthand story of life in Russian-occupied Ukraine and a young man's daring escape.
His story is necessary because everyone is tired, and his story has a lot of motivation.
But first news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump says he doesn't know if every person in the U.S. is entitled to due process under the Constitution as his administration focuses on deporting people in the U.S. illegally. In a broad-ranging interview on NBC's Meet the Press, Trump also says he's not worried about a recession, this amid his trade wars with several countries. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
Trump put in place these sweeping tariffs on many countries throughout the globe, and then he pulled back on them, but he still has left a 10% tariff on many imports from around the globe with the goal of negotiating trade deals. Last week, different economic advisors came out and alluded to the fact that they were very close to a deal, but we still haven't seen a deal, and I will say that trade deals take a really long time to figure out in terms of the nitty-gritty details.
NPR's Asma Khalid reporting. Some military veterans say they're seeing more delays in health care from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Chuck Warmbach of member station WUWM has more from a roundtable held by Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin this weekend.
Ryan McCants is an Army veteran who sustained what he calls pretty gnarly injuries during deployment in Afghanistan. He often relies on VA health care for both physical problems and mental health concerns. McCants says access to care has become more difficult over the last few months.
Specifically, I just called 3 days ago to try and schedule a new appointment with my therapist. I can't get in until August, mid-August, to see my therapist.
VA Secretary Doug Collins is scheduled to testify this week before a Senate committee. He's promised a proposed cut of up to 15% of the agency's workforce would not harm the quality of veterans' health care. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
Israel is vowing retribution after a missile fired by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen landed near Israel's main airport today. NPR's Carrie Kahn has more.
Sirens went off in many cities in central Israel, including Tel Aviv, early Sunday morning, sending Israelis into bomb shelters and halting flights at the international airport. The missile or debris from it fell in a field near Ben-Gurion Airport. Most missiles from Yemen are intercepted, but some have penetrated Israeli airspace and caused damage. A Yemeni official posted on social media that the attack is a warning to international airlines to not fly into Israel's main airport. Since the start of the Gaza war in solidarity with Palestinians, the Houthis have sent missiles into Israel. Israel's defense minister says forces will no longer use restraint against Yemen, adding, quote, whoever harms us, we will harm them sevenfold. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News. In Brazil, authorities say they foiled a planned bombing at a free outdoor Lady Gaga concert, and the two people are in custody. Police say the suspects were recruiting participants to carry out attacks using improvised explosive devices targeting LGBTQ people. Brazil's Ministry of Justice and Public Security says the plot was allegedly organized by a larger extremist network that operates online to radicalize young people and provoke hate crimes. Gaga played to some 2 million people, the biggest attendance for a female artist, beating Madonna's draw of 1.6 million people at her free concert in Brazil last year. Thunderbolts, Marvel's latest team-building exercise, is off to a decent start at box office around the world. NPR's Bob Mondello has more.
For a film about decidedly minor Marvel characters, Thunderbolts did just fine.
You feel fulfilled?
Yeah, so full. So filled.
By the end of the weekend, it will have taken in about $76 million in North America and another $86 million overseas, for a total of $162 million in 3 days. That's hardly huge for a Marvel movie, but Thunderbolts wasn't hugely expensive to produce. It's expected to play well for much of the summer. Also performing well, the third weekend of the blues-inflected vampire film, Sinners.
We're gonna kill every last one of you.
In 3 weeks, Sinners has now collected almost $180 million just in North America. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne, in for Scott Detrow. President Trump is questioning the due process rights of people in the United States. During a wide-ranging interview on NBC News' Meet the Press with Kristen Welker, Trump said the courts and legal proceedings are getting in his way from deporting millions. When asked whether he needs to uphold the Constitution, Trump said, quote, I don't know. Here with more on the president's words is NPR reporter Luke Garrett. Hi, Luke.
Hello.
So let's start with Trump's comments on due process. What did he say about the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees the right to due process, and about upholding the Constitution?
Right. NBC's Kristen Welker asked the president if he thinks both citizens and non-citizens deserve due process their day in court. Trump responded by saying he wants to deport millions and doesn't know if deportees deserve this due process. When asked whether this violates the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, Trump said he was elected on the promise of mass deportation, but the courts were preventing him from doing that. NBC's Welker then pressed the president on this very issue.
Don't you need to uphold the Constitution of the United States as president?
I don't know. I have to respond by saying again, I have brilliant lawyers that work for me. And they are going to obviously follow what the Supreme Court said.
And it's worth noting here that Trump's comments are in line with what's being said by the Department of Homeland Security. DHS spokeswoman Trisha McLaughlin has repeatedly told NPR that people the administration deems terrorists get a different sort of due process as allowed under the Alien Enemies Act. Ultimately, the Supreme Court is likely to rule on this issue. But the lower courts have already started to weigh in. Last week, a court partially blocked Trump's use of the act to deport Venezuelans.
Okay, let's move on to the economy. What did the president have to say about the possibility of a recession?
President Trump said he wasn't worried about an economic recession, but he didn't rule one out. Last week, the Commerce Department reported that the U.S. economy shrank by an annual rate of 0.3% in the first quarter of the year. Economists commonly define a recession as two consecutive quarters of decline. And during the interview, Trump did acknowledge some, quote, bad parts of the economy, but he blamed those on former President Biden. But when asked by NBC's Welker on whether a short-term recession was worth potential long-term gains for the U.S. economy, Trump notably said,
look, everything's okay. What we are, I said, this is a transition period. I think we're going to do fantastically.
He said ultimately tariffs would make the U.S., quote, rich, though most economists say tariffs would increase how much Americans pay for goods.
What about tariffs? Did Trump announce any of the promised trade deals he's been talking about with other countries?
So no, he didn't. But Trump did say relations with China on tariffs are improving.
At some point, I'm going to lower them because otherwise you could never do business with them.
But then later, Trump, talking about his overall tariff policy, said he's never going to take the possibility of permanent tariffs off the table.
No, I wouldn't do that, because if somebody thought they were going to come off the table, why would they build in the United States?
And last week, a Chinese official told NPR Beijing is, quote, assessing the situation after what it says have been multiple overtures from the United States seeking trade talks. So, Don, next week, all eyes will be looking out for these promised finalized tariff deals, especially with China.
That's NPR's Luke Garrett. Luke, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump has repeatedly promised that he would save the U.S. auto industry and that aggressive tariffs would drive that industry revival. This weekend, a 25% tariff on imported automobile parts kicked in. Other potentially very large tariffs remain in the mix, though some are on again and off again. Auto workers, meanwhile, are watching all of this closely. Many of them say tariffs will bring jobs back to the U.S., but even there you find some skepticism about Trump's methods. Tariffs were a big topic at a rally Trump held outside Detroit this week. That's where I met Jimmy Suter and Bill Beers.
You're wearing auto workers for Trump. Are you guys auto workers?
Yes.
Both are big Trump fans. Both give the president high praise for his first 100 days. This is Beers.
I mean, my main concern was immigration. So he's put a halt on the immigration. That was the very first reason I voted for him, to close down our borders. And then the economy. And the tariffs is just part of his plan to boost the economy.
On that latter point, he's got full confidence in Trump. Beers is retired. Suter is still working. They believe the tariffs will be a boon to the car industry and other domestic manufacturing. And they're not worried about them driving up prices or causing layoffs or about the overall uncertainty created by Trump's strategy. Here's Suter.
Trump has his entire life been built on negotiating. Let the man who's been doing it every day, all day, for 50-plus years, do it.
I agree.
Those standing on the outside looking in don't have no idea what he's doing.
Everybody's trying to coach the game from the bleachers.
Mm-hmm.
Let the man we elected, the businessman we elected, do what he's wanting to do, and then we'll see what happens.
But even at a Trump rally like this, you do find some voices who will offer a word of caution. In line outside was Mike Senkowski. He's not an auto worker in the true sense of the word, someone who worked on the assembly line, but he spent his career as an engineer supporting and retooling local plants. He voted for Trump, he supports Trump, but he's been watching the markets closely too.
And I tell my buddies, I go, man, I certainly hope this works, you know, because if it doesn't, that's a problem, you know. I had my faith in him, but if the one thing that I wish he would have done a little different is the tariff thing, and maybe not have been so heavy-handed with it and using it as a threat almost.
Call him loyal but nervous. He says he thinks Trump's got about 6 months to show some real progress with the tariffs. The United Auto Workers Union endorsed Kamala Harris in last year's election, calling Trump out as a scab and anti-union. But UAW leadership has gotten behind the call for tariffs, even while still battling Trump on nearly everything else. This past week at UAW headquarters in Detroit, we sat down with two local union leaders. Luigi Jokai is the vice president of UAW Local 51 at the Mack Avenue truck plant. His auto working roots stretch back to his grandfather, who immigrated from Albania and worked the line at Chrysler while raising a family in the Detroit suburbs.
Literally the American dream. Literally the American dream, what he came to America for. And when I first got hired in, I still remember his voice telling me, good job, boy, you have a good job. You can raise family now and get married, and I don't have to worry about you no more.
J.J. Jewell, meanwhile, represents about 300 UAW members at Ford's Sterling Axle Plant. That's Local 228. He got his start on the assembly line a few years after the industry almost went belly up during the financial crisis of 2008. The union agreed to concessions back then, with all new workers, like Jewell, getting a much lower hourly wage.
Hired in at $15.78 an hour in 2012, over, 11 years at that point, it took me to make $22 an hour. $22.50 was the top out.
Neither is a Trump supporter. Jewel voted for Harris last year, while Jokaj didn't vote for a presidential candidate. The union faults Democrats and Republicans alike for decades of bad trade deals that it says costs the U.S. millions of factory jobs. Both men do give Trump credit for taking action on trade, but they're skeptical whether his tariffs will produce the results he promises.
Made a lot of big promises talking about tariffs and things like that. And I mean, they're bold. Are they going to work? There's potential there. I think some of the rhetoric lines up with what the UAW has been saying for 60 and 70 and 80 years. Keep the product built in America with American workforce, with a fair wage, fair benefits. But is that going to happen? We have yet to see. I have yet to see that.
I'm going to characterize you both as just broadly in favor of the concept of tariffs as a way to support American workers and UAW workers.
One tool, yes.
Okay, that's it's one tool. That's right, one tool. So, but you understand why people are freaked out about them and why the markets have done what they've done, and how do we kind of how do we reconcile these things?
So I will not have a master's degree level analysis for you, but doing them in a calculated way, not being so heavy-handed or knee-jerk reaction or so excessive sometimes, where we're doing it in a very targeted manner that maximizes the benefits to our country and minimizes the fallout on our citizens.
Is it that he's got a good idea, but he's like doing it in such a Trumpian way?
Words out of my mouth. Yes, I don't think he knows the phrase in moderation.
Is that a problem? I mean, is he blowing the opportunity to potentially use this tool that you think is so important by the way he's going about it?
On a broad level, yes, I believe so. Because there's still the chance that even doing it in such a Trumpian way, that long-term big picture, we're going to see some positive effects of insourcing. But that's years away. The amount of time to build a new U.S. factory or to retool one or to bring those jobs back in, dropping the hammer as heavy as you can still won't bring them back overnight. So we need to be able to maintain, you know, relations with other countries while giving the entire market a chance to correct. That takes time.
Touching on JJ's point, it's a tool, and I think it should be used in the way a surgeon would use a tool. We don't want to cut the whole arm off. We're not going for the artery, but we need to really slice away certain pieces of it to make sure we do this the right way. Because if you do it the wrong way, you can blow this whole thing up overnight. And you got to be careful. But at the same time, you got to do, I don't want to say drastic things, but something needs to be done to correct the imbalances.
Jewel and Jokaj say they are worried about just how long the tariff turbulence will last. And they're not the only ones. While they wait to see if Trump's roll of the dice does indeed bring auto jobs home, voters around the country are increasingly worried about how and what a trade war might cost them. This is NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump says he doesn't know if the Constitution requires due process for the millions of migrants his administration is trying to deport, but he tells NBC's Meet the Press his lawyers will follow Supreme Court rulings. In the wide-ranging interview that aired today, Trump also minimized the risk of a recession amid his trade wars. Police in Brazil foiled an alleged planned bombing at Lady Gaga's free concert last night, and two suspects are in custody. Gaga played to 2 million people, beating Madonna's 1.6 million attendance numbers at her concert there last year. And police in London say they've arrested 8 men suspected of plotting terrorist attacks. They say 7 are Iranians. The nationality of the 8th has not been released. Officials have also not disclosed their targets. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome.
Grazie. Nice to see you all.
It's Sunday morning, and Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, is getting ready for Mass. Every member of the College of Cardinals is assigned a Roman church that they're nominally in charge of. And days before the beginning of the conclave to select the next pope, Dolan is visiting his church to celebrate 11:15 Mass. The ceremonies and rituals surrounding the death of one pope and the election of another all take place in ornate ancient cathedrals. That is not the scene at Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mount Mario, in a residential Roman neighborhood. It looks like scores of other parish churches around the globe. The statue of Jesus isn't sculpted by Michelangelo. It's a painted plaster of Jesus with a sacred heart and red robes. The prayers of the faithful are read by an Italian teenager wearing a hoodie. Dolan delivers his homily in Italian. He tells the congregation that Our Lady of Guadalupe is his second parish after St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan. And he asks them to pray for him and the other cardinals, saying they need the Holy Spirit as they enter the upcoming conclave. Then he says he recalls Pope Francis's advice to keep homilies short and says, enough.
So basta. Grazie.
When Mass ends, Cardinal Dolan stands at the door of the church, greeting parishioners, posing for pictures of children, kissing babies.
Mamma mia, trovarvi qui. Grazie. Buona domenica a tutti, eh?
And after that, he spends a few minutes with another important contingency, the media. Reporters from all over the world crowd around him, asking questions about the coming conclave and what he wants to see in the next pope.
You know, we're blessed because with all the popes we've recently had, you see so many great characteristics. And you kind of hope that maybe we could blend them all. I'm thinking, obviously, of Papa Francesco. I think, though, of Benedict XVI with his intense intellect. I'm thinking of Pope St. John Paul II with his courage and his call to follow Jesus. If we get a beautiful combination, that'll be a blessing.
What are you taking from your experience in 2013? How has that affected how
it
you're
helps.
Approaching this?
I was so nervous last time, and I thought, now what do I do? But now I feel kind of seasoned, a little more relaxed.
To get a sense of what happens next, I talked to an NPR voice who knows more about conclaves than anyone else at the network, our longtime Rome correspondent, Silvia Pajoli. We spoke at the edge of St. Peter's Square, looking out at St. Peter's Basilica and the roof of the Sistine Chapel, where the conclave will get underway on Wednesday. It is a bright, sunny day here in St. Peter's Square. The square is filled with tourists and religious pilgrims, which is common. What's uncommon are the signs of preparation for the conclave all around us. The conclave begins Wednesday. There are big platforms with TV lights for the media, huge TV monitors around the square so that people can watch feeds of the Sistine Chapel chimney. There are wooden fences to corral the expected crowds of hundreds of thousands who will crowd the square when a pope is chosen. Silvia Pajoli has covered the Vatican and several conclaves for NPR, and she joins me on the edge of Vatican City to talk through what's to come. Welcome, Sylvia.
Thank you for having me here.
Let's start with this setting. You and I are both looking out at St. Peter's Basilica at the square right now. And if we crane our necks just enough from where we're sitting, we can see the edge of the Sistine Chapel chimney that was just put in place. Can we start by talking about the significance of where we're located right now?
Well, that Sistine Chapel, it's the one with all the wall and the ceiling, magnificent frescoes that Michelangelo completed in 1512. We can't see it, but there's a copper pipe that leads from the chimney to a cast iron stove inside the chapel where the cardinal's ballots will be burned. The color of the smoke will signal the results of the balloting, black for no pope elected, and white smoke when there is a new pope.
At one hand, this is an election just like any other election, right? There's caucusing going on, there's votes that are going to be cast. On the other hand, there's this extreme pageantry and ritual. You've covered a number of conclaves. What makes this process so unique?
Well, precisely that. I think the colorful ritual and, of course, the secrecy. When they enter the conclave, the cardinals take an oath of secrecy on penalty of excommunication, and they must make their decision without any outside influence. To ensure they'll be held incommunicado from the rest of the world as they vote, mobile phones are banned. There's no TV, no radio, no newspapers. In addition, Vatican workers have installed a raised wooden flooring, not to just to protect the marble floors below, but perhaps also to hide electronic jamming equipment. And Vatican security will sweep the chapel for hidden microphones and other listening devices.
Despite our best attempts, I guess. Obviously, the focus is on this ritual that begins on Wednesday. But a lot's going on right now, and that's a process that's pretty important to the eventual outcome. Walk us through what the cardinals have been up to in the days since Pope Francis's funeral.
Well, all the cardinals, voting age, and even the over 80-year-olds, have been meeting in what are called congregations, discussing many issues that the Catholic Church is now facing. A serious deficit in the Vatican finances to clerical sex abuse scandals that have come to light throughout the world. And these are scandals that have been dealt with very, very poorly by most of the national churches. Mm-hmm. The cardinals are expected to observe secrecy, but there have been some leaks that suggest the various factions have begun to face off. The progressives, who embrace the reforms of Pope Francis, the conservatives and traditionalists who want to slow down the pace of reform, if not reverse it completely, and the centrists, who are somewhere in between.
Who makes up the College of Cardinals?
There are 53 voting age cardinals from Europe, 17 from South America, 16 from North America, 18 from Africa, and 23 from Asia. The total comes to 135. Two are too sick to attend, which means 133 will elect the new pope, compared to 115 in the last conclave that elected Jorge Bergoglio. Mm-hmm. The novelty this time is that many of the cardinals have never met, so they're now getting to know each other, making alliances, and promoting their candidates or even themselves as future popes.
When we think about the blocks here, there's a lot of focus on the geography. You just mentioned the different locations they come from. There's also this focus on which Pope appointed them. Are these both the important factors to think about?
Yeah, very much so. Pope Francis appointed some 80% of the voting cardinals, and he chose men from faraway countries where there had never been cardinals before. His picks are not necessarily all progressives, but they reflect the fact that the growth of Catholicism has shifted from Europe and North America to the global south.
So let's look ahead to Wednesday morning when you and I and the rest of the NPR team will be settling in here to look at a chimney with binoculars. What all is going to happen to begin this ritual?
A mass will be celebrated in St. Peter's in the morning, and in the afternoon, the cardinals will be escorted by Vatican gendarmes to the Sistine Chapel. Once inside, the master of liturgical celebrations will say the words extra omnes, meaning all who aren't cardinal electors, get out. After that, the door is shut. Conclave, after all, means with key. And the waiting begins.
So when they're in the Sistine Chapel, they're sitting there in silence. But can we assume that there is politicking, there is debating, there is campaigning going on in the other spaces when they're all together?
Well, many of us have seen the movie Conclave that suggested that there's quite a lot of communication and scheming between cardinals and nuns and other Vatican prelates at the residence where the cardinals take their meals and are lodged when not in the Sistine Chapel. I think that's pretty exaggerated, but there's no question that they certainly do talk and caucus among themselves.
And I want to ask you the two questions that I feel like you've probably been fielding from everybody you've come across the last couple of weeks. The first question is, how long do you think it's going to take? Do we have any sense how long this could be?
My guess is that the latest by Friday, we should hear the name of the new pope.
And second question, do you have a guess on who it might be, or at least the type of person we're thinking about?
Well, I can tell you who the favorites are, according to the leading Vaticanisti. Those are the veteran journalists who cover the Vatican. There's the current Secretary of State, Pietro Parolin, 70 years old, a veteran diplomat. He's the architect of the Vatican's rapprochement with China, which makes him disliked by many conservatives. He could be described as a centrist. Mm-hmm. Then there's another Italian, Pier Battista Pizzaballa, the 60-year-old Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, who offered himself in exchange for Israeli hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza. And he's said to have support of both ends of the conservative and progressive spectrum. Then there's Luis Antonio Tagle, 67 years old, from the Philippines, Asia's biggest Catholic country, who's seen as very much in the Francis mold. And then there are several others that have, who have been mentioned in the last few days. At the same time, there's also been an uptick in negative rumors and fake news on social media about some of the front runners. And that's a sign that there are some very strong papabili, possible popes.
That is NPR's Silvia Poggioli. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
We've got a Cosmos 482 coming right up. No, it is not a cocktail. It is a spacecraft. The Soviet-era planetary probe, Cosmos 482, was sent from Earth on a mission to Venus in the year 1972. However, technical malfunctions ensued. It went off course, and the spacecraft never made it out of Earth's orbit. It has now been stuck in that orbit, circling and circling and circling for over 50 years. But now, it seems like Cosmos 482 might finally be coming home. As scientists predict, it will plunge back to Earth sometime this month. Jonathan McDowell is an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He is here to help us make sense of this fascinating story. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, it's a fun little event.
So describe the spacecraft. How big is it? What's it look like? All of that.
Right. It's a sphere about 3 feet across. It's about half a ton. So like the weight of a small car. And it was designed to survive entry into the hellish Venusian atmosphere, but the rocket stage malfunctioned, and so it didn't have enough speed to escape Earth's gravity. And so it ended up in an orbit that had its initial low point of only about 150 miles, and the high point was as high as 6,000 miles. And so every hour or so, it would loop around the Earth, going down to 150, up to 6,000. And every time it goes down, it plows through the outer edge of Earth's atmosphere, slows down a tiny little bit, so it doesn't go quite as high the next time. But it took 50 years to bleed off enough height to bring it down now to being on the edge of reentry.
Okay, the way you describe that, to bleed off enough height, it's so, so gradual.
That's right. And now it's in its final death plunge.
So people listening are probably thinking to themselves, okay, we're always hearing about satellite X, Y, or Z falling out of orbit, burning up in the atmosphere before they hit the ground, and that's that. Will that be the case with Cosmos 482?
Well, because it has a heat shield and it was designed to survive the rigors of Venus's atmosphere, what I expect is instead of burning up and melting, it will re-enter essentially undamaged. And so somewhere on Earth, this half-ton sphere will fall out of the sky at a couple hundred miles an hour. And most likely, it'll be over the ocean and no one will ever know.
Overwhelmingly likely that it hits a body of water, one of the oceans, or some unpopulated space, some unpopulated area. But you never know.
You never know. There's a not trivial chance that it could hit somewhere where it damages property. And there's a small chance, but it's like one in thousands that it could hurt someone.
Cosmos 482, it was supposed to go to Venus. It never made it. It's coming back home. Who knows where? That's Jonathan McDowell, astrophysicist at the Smithsonian Observatory, located at Harvard University. Thanks, Jonathan. And we've got our hard hats handy here.
Absolutely. I'm ready to duck.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Many Republican-led states have been cutting income taxes in recent years, and now Mississippi lawmakers say they're going to do away with their state's income tax entirely. Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Will Stribling reports from Jackson that this leaves questions about how the state will fund core services.
Surrounded by lawmakers in March, Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves signed a bill into law he says fulfills a longtime goal.
We can all stand together and say that we have accomplished income tax elimination in the state of Mississippi. Let me say that again. Mississippi will no longer tax the work, the earnings, or the ambition of its people.
Really, the bill just lowers the personal income tax rate from 4% to 3% by 2030. Then, it could be phased out over the next decade if the state's economy grows. Lawmakers even passed the bill knowing there was a typo that allows tax cuts when economic growth is much smaller than originally intended. Opponents say income taxes are more fair than taxing things like groceries or gas taxes, which are going up. The state ranks low in spending on schools and health care, and Democratic House Minority Leader Robert Johnson said it can't afford to cut income taxes.
You won't have a hospital to go to. Doctors will have to move away because they can't get paid. It's going to be a disaster. And these people are going to have a day of reckoning when it comes to how we provide services in this state.
Mississippi is going further than other states, but it's far from the only one slashing tax rates. Kentucky is also working to phase out its income tax. Other states reduced it as their budgets were supercharged by federal pandemic-related spending.
We saw 28 states reduce their individual income tax rates in the past 4 years alone. So this is really the biggest wave of state income tax reform and relief the U.S. has ever seen. It's really, really significant.
That's Catherine Lughead. She's a senior analyst and research manager at the Tax Foundation, which promotes tax policies aimed at creating economic growth. Several states, like Texas and Florida, have never had an income tax, but it's been decades since the state did away with them. Proponents of income tax phase-out say they attract businesses and people to the state. Here's Republican House Speaker Jason White.
It comes from a core belief that it is better to tax someone based on the things they purchase and not tax them based on their productivity or their livelihood or their income.
But some economists warn the end of federal pandemic-era spending, coupled with lower income tax revenues, could force lawmakers to increase other taxes in ways that discourage business growth. Stephen Sheffrin is a professor of economics at Tulane University.
Unless you cut your spending totally, you're going to basically be relying more on property taxes and more on sales taxes. And a lot of that's not going to just come from individuals, it's going to come from business.
And if states are all cutting, it could turn into a race to the bottom that wipes out any competitive edge. And Sheffrin says it can make a state less attractive.
Ultimately, what does matter is, you know, how your education system is operating, what other incentives there are in the tax code, infrastructure, how the roads are, and all those other factors which are really important.
As they focused on cutting the income tax in the spring legislative session, lawmakers failed to pass a state budget. Governor Reeves is expected to call lawmakers back in the next few weeks for a special session, where they'll have to work out how much to spend on big-ticket items like schools and roads. For NPR News, I'm Will Stribling in Jackson, Mississippi.
This is NPR News.
Boarding domestic flights will look a little different soon. You'll have to show something called a real ID to get on a plane, but don't worry.
There is some good news here. There's some wiggle room built into the system because they knew that not everyone would be ready.
Everything you need to do about real ID on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israeli authorities are vowing retaliation after a missile attack this morning. Houthi rebels based in Yemen have claimed responsibility. The missile landed near Israel's main international airport outside of Tel Aviv, but flights resumed today. Tomorrow, the federal government resumes collecting defaulted student loan payments for the first time since the start of the pandemic. The agency says about two-thirds of the 43 million borrowers who owe money haven't made regular payments. This comes after years of legal back and forth about loan forgiveness at a time when borrowers are stretched thin from inflation. And jury selection gets underway tomorrow in New York City in the federal criminal trial of Sean Diddy Combs. The music mogul is charged with sex trafficking and racketeering. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Ukrainians have been riveted in recent weeks by a teenager's story of his daring escape from the Russian-occupied East. The story he tells describes life under occupation and the enormous obstacles facing those who want to leave. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley and interpreter Katerina Malafieva met him and have this report.
Ivan Sarancha has become a hero in Ukraine. Here he recounts his escape from enemy territory in yet another TV interview.
It's him! Ah, Dobrodin!
Hello!
Hello!
We meet the shy, broad-shouldered 18-year-old near the shelter in Kyiv, where he's living alongside Ukrainians who have fled towns along the front lines. But Sarancha is different. He left behind his parents and a safe home in Luhansk, Ukraine's easternmost province that's been largely under Kremlin control since 2014. Sarancha was just 7 when the Kremlin annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and fomented unrest in the Donbas region where he lived. His home became a kind of gray zone as the separatists declared independence from Ukraine, proclaiming the Luhansk People's Republic. And the Kremlin had even bigger plans.
That's what it sounded like in Kyiv this morning as Ukrainians faced down the reality of a Russian invasion.
Sarancha says Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 opened his eyes. The killing of civilians in the Kyiv suburb of Bucha horrified him. He says his parents believed Russian propaganda that Ukraine had staged the massacre and made fake videos to sway global opinion.
I watched the Russian news and compared it with the Ukrainian and American news I could watch using a VPN, and I figured out what was true and false.
After the war started, his own town began to change dramatically.
Many Russians started moving to Luhansk. On my way to school one day, I counted more than 100 Russian flags along the main street. There were even flags with Putin's face on them. It really shocked me.
Sarancha joined pro-Ukraine groups online and began to speak Ukrainian, though only with his internet friends, a very political teenage secret life. He had to hide his views from his parents, who were fans of Putin. Sarancha says there's an undercurrent of fear in Luhansk, where expressing your opinion could land you in a place known as the cellar for interrogation or worse. He began to think of running away to free Ukraine. His first step was low tech. He says he tore a phone number from a flyer on a wall that read, "We help people from Luhansk go to Ukraine."
It's a very dangerous process. Not everybody's allowed to leave.
That's Kate. She's Russian and part of a network called Helping to Leave, a kind of underground railroad assisting Ukrainians trying to get out of Russian-occupied territory. It's dangerous work, so she can't give her last name. Kate says only a few hundred people were able to get out of occupied territory last year, and it's getting harder all the time. Direct routes into Ukraine are cut off by the front line. You have to pass through Russia or a third country like Belarus, which means going through a heavy search and interrogation process at the Russian border known as filtration.
There's a lot of intimidation from the Russian authorities. It definitely would be very frightening, and people would, again, check your phones, check your belongings, and sometimes look for a reason to kind of detain you.
To prepare mentally, Sarancha says he watched videos of how other people had made it through filtration. He realized his phone was full of pro-Ukrainian information, so he bought a new one and filled it with pro-Russian pictures and messages. Sarancha had both a secret and a plan. He got a job and saved money. With his 18th birthday approaching, he told his parents he'd like to go on his first solo trip to celebrate. His parents agreed he could spend a few days in Rostov-on-Don, a Russian city 100 miles south of Luhansk. Sarancha didn't tell them that from there he planned to travel on to Moscow and Belarus, then into Ukraine. He says he only had a two-day window.
I needed to be 18 to cross the border into Belarus without my parents' permission, he tells me.
But to leave Luhansk with no hassles, he needed to still be 17 and below Russian Army draft age. On a cold, dark morning this January, the day before his 18th birthday, Sarancha's father took him to the bus station.
I was sitting there thinking, what am I doing? Where will I be in a week? Luhansk? Russia? Ukraine? I was so worried. But I pulled myself together and decided to go all the way.
When he arrived in Rostov-on-Don, he checked into a hotel for the day. Following the instructions of his telephone guide, he took pictures of himself in the room and in different changes of clothing at popular sites around the city. That evening, he sent them to his parents so they wouldn't suspect anything, then boarded a bus for the 600-mile overnight trip to Moscow. He arrived the next day, his birthday.
My parents called me, and they like to drink a lot. So they started celebrating my birthday early, and that was to my advantage. So I told them, go ahead and celebrate. Don't worry about me.
Sarancha took a train on to Minsk, the capital of Belarus. He'd brought along food, but was too nervous to eat. Once in Belarus, he headed straight to the Ukrainian embassy.
When I saw the flag of Ukraine for the first time, it was so big and beautiful. I had tears in my eyes. I remembered last seeing it in the first grade.
Showing the only Ukrainian document he had, a birth certificate, Sarancha was able to obtain a temporary Ukrainian passport. The last stop on his risky trip was the Belarusian border with Ukraine. They told me, unlock your phone and hand it over, he remembers. Sarancha says the tension was unbearable, but he stayed calm as they scrolled through his phone, searched his bag, and questioned him. Eventually, they let him through. He says at first his parents didn't believe he was in Ukraine. His father cursed him. His mother was hysterical. Sarancha says he wants his parents to recognize the truth about this war and has threatened to block them on his phone until they do. He also misses them terribly. Ukrainian TV reporter Karina Kirichenko has come to interview Saranja. She says he's become an inspiration for the nation.
His story is necessary for all Ukrainians just now because everyone is tired and his story has a lot of motivation.
Saranja is proof, she says, that Russia's indoctrination of a younger generation in the occupied territories may not be working after all, and that there are Ukrainians waiting to be liberated. Eleanor Beardsley with Katerina Malofieva, NPR News, Kyiv.
More Americans with mental health needs have been getting talk therapy in recent years, according to a new study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports that it's the first time in decades that talk therapy has played a bigger role in mental health treatment than medications.
For many years, since the late 1990s, the use of psychotherapy or talk therapy declined and then plateaued. But that trend changed between 2018 and 2021. The new study finds that the number of American adults getting outpatient talk therapy grew from 6.5% to 8.5%.
That's an increase from about 16.5 million to nearly 22 million people.
Dr. Mark Olson is a psychiatrist and epidemiologist at Columbia University and an author of the new study. While a majority of people getting therapy also use psychiatric medication like antidepressants and antipsychotic meds, the study also found that for the first time in decades, fewer people relied only on medication.
When Prozac first came on the scene and the other antidepressants like it, the SSRIs followed, medications have assumed a more and more important role. Here, for the first time in many years, we're seeing that flip.
In fact, Olson says more people are getting a combination of medication and talk therapy. And when people start talk therapy, he says, they're more likely to stick to it.
One of the problems historically has been that sometimes people show up for one visit and then they'll drop out prematurely.
But in recent years, says Dr. Jesse Gold, people are more aware about what to expect from therapy. Gold is a psychiatrist and chief wellness officer at the University of Tennessee.
So if we see an increase in talk therapy because people feel like they have things they want to talk about or could use the help or help seeking's more normalized, I think that's a great thing. And it might be in part what you're seeing.
That's in addition to wider access to talk therapy through telehealth since the COVID-19 pandemic.
Telehealth did increase access for people who might not have had any access to a therapist in their particular location or times.
Despite the growing access to talk therapy documented in the new study, the most recent data from a national survey shows that only about half of Americans with any mental illness received any treatment in the year before. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
The College of Cardinals will gather this week to elect the next pope, who will be tasked with leading the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. One important aspect of the conclave is the location itself, the Sistine Chapel. My colleague Scott Detrow recently learned more about it.
The setting for the upcoming conclave to elect the next pope is one of the most dramatic and historic on the planet. When 133 cardinals gather, all wearing their scarlet-red choir dress, they will meet in the Vatican's famous Sistine Chapel, and they will be surrounded by some of the most important artistic works of the Renaissance. When they look up, they will see the ceiling painted by Michelangelo telling the story of the creation in Genesis. On the north and south walls, frescoes tell the stories of Jesus and Moses. And as the cardinals approach the chapel's altar to cast their ballots, they will be walking toward Michelangelo's floor-to-ceiling vivid illustration of the Last Judgment. Here is how Robert Harris, the author of the bestseller Conclave, thinks about it.
And that's a pretty awesome piece of art with the dead, the souls of the dead plunging down into hell and the souls of the virtuous rising to heaven. I think if you saw that four times a day, you would it would enter your soul. And of course, that along with the Sistine Chapel ceiling are what were meant to focus the minds of the cardinal electors.
Quite the scene. Here to take us through the Sistine Chapel's art and its significance to the conclave is American University Renaissance art professor Kim Butler. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's pretend we are walking into the Sistine Chapel together, as the cardinals will be doing. Tell us what we're seeing.
Well, the cardinal electors will have a very different experience than your average tourist. They will be in a smaller group. 133 cardinal electors will process from the rear of the chapel toward the altar wall. As they are processing, they will be singing a 9th century hymn, Veni Creator Spiritus, which means, Come Holy Spirit, Creator. Bring us your gifts by your right finger. And as they are singing the hymn, they will walk under Michelangelo's iconic creation of Adam, which shows God with his divine finger infusing the Holy Spirit into the first created man, Adam. So this is a very powerful connection for them as they are seeking guidance from the Holy Spirit.
You mentioned the typical tourist experience. The one time I was there, I recall the people with sticks kind of guiding people through. Obviously, very, very different. It's an intimate setting, and yet this towering, intimidating artwork surrounding the cardinals.
Yes, that's right. And they will have ample opportunity to study the artworks. They will be seated at tables depending on their position. They will either face the scenes from the life of Christ or the life of Moses. Either way, they will be looking at examples of their pastoral purview. They will see examples of teaching scripture, of preaching, of model priesthood to which they should all aspire. And very importantly, on the right-hand side, one of the most famous early decorations in the chapel is Perugino's delivery of the keys. It's when Christ hands the keys to Peter, marking him as the first pope. Their job fundamentally is to elect the successor to Peter, and that's what they will be focusing on. And these models from the Old Testament and the New Testament are essentially showcasing the qualities they should be looking for in the next pope.
Let's talk about the Last Judgment, which, as we mentioned, is the background to this, is what cardinals will be looking at as they cast their ballots. Can you describe the painting?
Yes, the Last Judgment, it is a very imposing painting. Michelangelo was brought in by a third pope, Pope Paul III, to paint over the original altar wall decoration. And politics and religious culture had changed. He was coming in a few decades after he painted the ceiling to paint the altar wall for this new pope. But fundamentally, it was about the theology of salvation, how you are judged at the end of time. Are you on the Christ's right side? Are you among the elect? Or are you on the left side, the sinister side, being taken to hell?
One thing I do want to clarify is that we think about the conclave as this millennia-old practice. We think about the age of the Sistine Chapel, but this was not always the place for this vote to take place, right?
No, not at all. In fact, the first conclave that took place in the Sistine Chapel was in 1492. Papal conclaves were only held in the chapel a handful of times before 1878. Only at which time it became the standardized site. And there was a very chaotic history with conclaves. The reason that this tradition developed of locking them in with a key, cum clave, with the key, is because they would take forever sometimes in medieval conclaves. There was one conclave that took nearly 3 years. And they started doing things like locking the cardinal electors in, rationing their food and water, making sure they only had a very hard bed and a chamber pot to help facilitate the proceedings moving forward. And some of these were gradually implemented as rules.
That was American University art professor Kim Butler. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Walking on the fence. Bim had a beef bone and Tommy came to see. Bim snapped at Tommy's tail and chased him up a tree. Wow, 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 wow. Waking half the village up to hear the awful row.